We're starting a new series today called Ecclesiology. It's not a study through the book of Ecclesiastes. It's ecclesiology. It's the study of the church. One of the most impactful lessons that I can recall as a kid was an object lesson that one of my Sunday school teachers did. Her name was Susan McCormick. My family probably remembers that name. Her and her husband played a prominent role in one of the churches that I was raised in. But Susan taught Sunday school, and she basically sat down one Sunday morning, opened her Bible, and she pulled out a little magnet and a little round metal button. And she was talking to us about the importance of staying close to God. And she used that magnet as an example, and she set it in the middle of her Bible. And she said, look, the further away this little piece of metal gets, the harder it is for the magnet to attract it. And that stuck with me. I was probably only about 9 or 10 years old when she taught that lesson. And object lessons for me have always been so powerful. And I think today what we're going to see is Jesus uses one of the most powerful object lessons when he starts to talk about the church. Because we're going to look at the very first time the word church is mentioned in the New Testament. So I'm going to give you some background to that. But while I'm giving you background, I want you to flip over to Matthew chapter 16. And we're going to look at verses 13 through 20, but I'm really only going to focus in on one of those verses. So you'll find in Matthew chapter 16, verse 13, that Jesus takes his disciples to a region called Caesarea Philippi. And Caesarea Philippi provides a powerful backdrop for, I think, one of the most critical moments of Jesus' ministry. The setting that Jesus provides by going to Caesarea Philippi and the words that Jesus speaks in this text emphasize his person, his purpose, and his power. Now, I had all intentions of like going through all three of those things today, but as I begin to write this out and study more, we're only going to focus on just one of those today. But we would miss how powerful a moment this must have been for his disciples if we aren't familiar with the setting that's going on here. So let me read those few verses to you, and then I want to tell you what's going on. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Then he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. Caesarea Philippi is a very interesting place for Jesus to have taken his disciples. It's approximately 100 miles north of Jerusalem. It's on the far northern end of Galilee, and it was a center for pagan worship. Before Herod the Great's son Philip renamed the city after Caesar and himself, Philippi, the city was called Panias. The name of that city was derived from the Greek god of fertility known as Pan. So if you know your Greek mythology, you might know that Pan was part man, part goat. And during Jesus' time on earth and while he was at that city, it was still the center of Pan worship. And part of that worship to Pan was done at a cave. In Caesarea Philippi, there's a big cave. And originally, out of the mouth of that cave, there was a spring that fed the Jordan River. Later in history, there was an earthquake, and it altered the flow of the spring. But I have pictures for you that shows you what this would have looked like. So this would have been Caesarea Philippi and the sanctuary of Pan. Now, on the temple to your far left here, you can see the cave behind that temple. And so this would have been the image that Jesus and his disciples would have probably had in view as Jesus was asking them, who do you think that I am? This is what it looks like today. The temples are gone, but the cave is still there. Now, the entrance of this cave was known as the Gates of Hades. That's what people called this. The Greek and Roman worshipers believed that Pan and their other gods would enter into the cave, and that was the entrance to the underworld where they would spend the winter. And so people would travel to this place, and they would go to the Gates of Hades, and they would offer sacrifices to appease or to try to earn Pan's and the other gods' favor on their lives. Now, this is the place that Jesus chooses to talk about the church for the very first time. I think this is fascinating. You know, when we read this text, when he says the gates of Hades shall not overcome it, I don't think our minds go here. But this is where Jesus was most likely standing with this in view in Caesarea Philippi when he said the gates of Hades will not overcome the church. So this is the backdrop. This is what it looked like for the first time the church is mentioned in the New Testament. I want to start to pick apart this verse a little bit this morning. I want to focus on two key areas. This is the verse we're really going to dial into. And I tell you that you are Peter. And on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. So today you're going to feel probably a lot like you're in a classroom. I got a lot of church history thrown in here and a lot of Greek, but the Greek is extremely important. This is the word that you see when you see church. This is what it looks like in Greek. That's the Greek word. We transliterate this word ekklesia. It comes from two other Greek words, ek, which means out of, and kaleo, which means to call. So literally, this word ekklesia is a gathering or an assembly of people. Interestingly enough, we do not get our English word church from this word. We get our English word church from the old German word Kirk. Kirk literally means house or building of the Lord. Now, there's some significant differences in these two words. So what I want to do is I want to look at what happened. When did we see this change? When did we move away from ecclesia and toward church? The first English translation of the Bible that used the original Greek language was produced by a man named William Tyndale. Now, you're probably familiar with that last name, Tyndale. Tyndale Publishing House, it's one of the largest Christian publishing houses. But William Tyndale, in 1534, translated the Bible into the common vernacular. Now, Tyndale literally gave his life for people to be able to have the Bible in English. He was killed. He was martyred. And I don't want this to turn into a bash in one church or the other, but the Catholic Church had William Tyndale killed because they didn't want the Bible translated into English. Because it was illegal to translate the Bible into the common vernacular. So in 1534, he translated this, and this is what Tyndale's writing looks like. Now, it's in Old English, so I didn't have something going on when I was typing this out. Now, you'll notice in Tyndale's translation, he uses the word, on this rock, I will build my congregation. Not church. And I think that's interesting. The reality is we don't have a good English word that translates ecclesia, but congregation or assembly probably comes pretty close. Now, if you fast forward about 80 years or so, you have the 1611 King James Version Bible that was commissioned by King James, and now we see a change. There was the Geneva Bible in there too, and the Geneva Bible is pretty close to this. But now we see the word church. So the Puritans would have used the Geneva Bible, but they also translated this word ecclesia, church. And I want to give you my theory as to what's going on here in history, why we see this change. And I hope by the end of this, you'll see why I'm harping on this so much. So this is my theory. Why would King James and the King James Bible choose the word church? Well, the reality is the unity of England was threatened by the division of the church, because the Church of England and England were inseparable. And there was some division within the church, and that was causing some issues for the whole kingdom. So the original King James Version of 1611 came the century after the beginning of the Protestant Reformation. And England's state church, the Church of England, which we now know as the Anglican Church, was separate at this point in history from the Roman Catholic Church. And here's what was going on in England. Some people in England wanted to see the Church of England, join back with the Roman Catholic Church, while others, specifically the Puritans, thought that the church still resembled the Catholic Church too much, and they were seeking even more reformation. And then you had all these people kind of in between those two extremes. Well, it's a pretty well-known fact that King James was not a fan of the Geneva Bible, because in the Geneva Bible, it contained not just the text of the Bible, but there were lots of commentary and notes in the margins. And some of those notes and commentary seemed to challenge the monarchy. And so King James wasn't happy with that. He didn't want the monarchy challenged. And so he commissions a new translation, the King James Version, and one of the rules that he laid out in the translating process was it cannot have any notes or study commentary in the margins. And so now we have a translation that some people think is the only translation that can be used still today, that uses a word that I believe, this is just my personal opinion, I think the word was used to bolster the support of the Church of England. Because if we use a word like congregation, it might imply that that could happen anywhere and not just at the Church of England. So there's a lot of historical things going on here with this translation, not to mention the fact that we've taken so many steps away from the original word, ecclesia. These modern translations, and all of your English translations use the word church. All of the modern translations have followed after the 1611 King James Version and used the word church. But I don't think they carry the same significance as the original Greek. Outside of the New Testament, the word in that period of time, ecclesia, was used most often for the political realm to describe a delegate of people that were formed for a certain task. So if I were to give you some modern day examples of ecclesia, there's two that came to my mind really prominently because they play a pretty important role in this community. The Union County Development Corporation would be like an ecclesia. It's a group of people that are joined together for a specific purpose, or even the Union County Foundation. Those groups right there kind of conceptualize what ecclesia really meant. So I want you to write this down, because we're going to start building a working definition of the church according to the Bible, and this is the starting point. Jesus viewed the church not as a place, but as a community of people. That is so important for us to understand. Jesus viewed the church not as a place, but as a community of people. If I would have started this series in the spring, I would have had everybody go out to the parking lot and we would have had the service out in the parking lot today, just as an object lesson, that this building has nothing to do with the church. It has everything to do with all of you. So Jesus viewed the church not as a place, but as a community of people. And this kind of language that we use to talk about the church, it has some significance. We don't even realize how deeply ingrained it is for us to think of the church as a building. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, well, I'm going to the house of the Lord today, or I'm doing some work on the house of the Lord. The building is not the house of the Lord. The people inside the building is the house of the Lord. So the church is a group of people, and they're centered on one important thing. Now, I want to go back to the New International Version here. The church is a group of people that is centered on, now write this down too, the person of Jesus Christ. So this is what we see Matthew writing down. I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. And there's a phrase in here that has tripped people up for centuries. On this rock. And if you look through commentaries and you read through church history and you read through different denominations' viewpoint of how this is understood, there's a couple different ways that people take this. There's been debates for centuries among scholars. It's like, who or what is Jesus talking about when he says, on this rock I will build my church? Now here's why there's some issue with this. Because Matthew records Jesus switching up Peter's name. Remember earlier in the text, he said, I tell you, you're Simon, son of Jonah. And then later he says, and I tell you that you're Peter. Now he switches up his name, and that causes us some issue. Because here's what Peter means in Greek. It's Petros, and it means rock. And rock is Petra. So what you have is I tell you that you're a rock, and on this rock I will build my church. And some people say, well, you know, we can't really go by the Greek. It's probably Jesus was most likely speaking Aramaic. Okay, well, even if you look at Aramaic, Kepha is the Aramaic word for rock, and it's also the name Peter. So it's the same. So he says, I tell you that you're Petros, and on this Petra I will build my church. Now here's two traditional views of how we translate this verse. Some people translate this that Peter is the rock on which the church is built. Most notably, this is the Catholic Church's stance. Not just the Catholic Church, but there's other denominations out there that believe and feel this same way. So the Catholic Church takes this text and they say, look, Jesus said, you're the rock, and on this rock I'm building my church. So that's why, if you know much about the Catholic Church and their history, Peter is recognized as the first pope of the Catholic Church because of this. Because they read this and translate it as, hey, Jesus said it right there. You're the rock, and on the rock I'm going to build my church. Now, there's another mainstream translation, and this other mainstream translation is that, well, Peter's not actually the rock. It's the confession that Peter makes that is the rock. Okay? Now, they will tell you this, they believe this, because there's a change in the ending of the word. So Petros is a male ending, Petra is a female ending of the word. So they say if it's a female ending, it can't be referring to the male name, it has to be referring to something else, so it has to be the confession that Peter makes. And the confession was what? You're the Messiah. You're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. So here we have these two mainstream translations, and some of us are probably saying, okay, well, which one's the right one? Which one is it? Well, I want to propose a third option. I'm not sure that we have to pick one of these views and say, hey, this one's the right one, this one's the wrong one. I think we can take a blend and find what's appropriate. Now, let me try to explain what I mean here. How did Jesus use this imagery, the rock imagery, in other accounts? In Matthew chapter 7, verses 24 through 27, Jesus is talking about a wise man and foolish man. And in this account, he says, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. It's the same Greek word, Petra. And what's the foundation at this point? Well, whoever hears these words of mine and puts them into practice. It's the teachings of Jesus. That's the rock. That's the foundation. So Jesus himself in other places uses it as, hey, my teachings are the foundation. Add this to the setting. You know, if we were to go back to this, all the way back to this picture, and you see this huge rock outcropping in the background. You know, these temples were built into it with niches that were built into it. Jesus could have been illustrating the significance. Hey, look, Peter, you just called me the Messiah, and that's like this giant rock foundation, and I'm going to build my church on that. So Jesus, you know, implies other places, hey, it's my teachings. Those are the most important things. Okay? Now, how do the other New Testament writers perceive this? Well, this is what Paul said. For no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. So Paul's saying, hey, look, Jesus is the rock. But what if we back up just one more verse? By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as a wise builder, and someone else is building on it. But each one should build with care, for no one can lay any foundation other than one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, wait a minute. What's Paul talking about? He said, I laid a foundation, but then he said, Jesus. Or if you go to Ephesians chapter 2, verses 19 through 20. Consequently, you are no longer foreigners and strangers, but fellow citizens with God's people and also members of his household, built on the foundation of, now watch what he says, built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets with Jesus Christ himself as the chief cornerstone. Now we have more. What about Peter? You know, the one that made this confession. The rock himself, what did he have to say? Well, in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 and 5, this is what he said. As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans, but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, now wait a minute, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood. What in the world are Paul and Peter talking about? Is it not just Jesus who's the foundation of the church? Now, there's something very interesting going on here when you take all this into account. The confession of Jesus as Messiah, the person of Jesus, that's who Peter's talking about. You're the Messiah, the Son of the Living. That was the rock on which Jesus would build his church. But at the same time, those who make that confession are also the rock. Now, here's what I don't think we can do from this text. What I don't think we can do from Matthew chapter 16 is make an argument for some kind of apostolic succession. Personally, I don't think we can look at this and say, hey, Peter's the first pope, and there has to be some kind of apostolic succession that's the head of the church from that point on. I don't think that's what's going on here. But in the context of this verse, I do think that we need to understand that Jesus is not just asking Peter alone who people say that he is. When Jesus stops and turns around and he says, who do you say that I am? Jesus is not looking directly at Peter because it's the plural form of the word. So if we were in Kentucky, if Jesus was at a cave in Kentucky, he would have turned around and said, who do y'all think that I am? He was addressing the group. Peter's the only one that answers with the right answer. But we know from the rest of the New Testament that all the others at that particular point in time that were with Jesus, they all come to the same conclusion. They all come to the same conclusion that he is the Messiah. You know, when I was doing landscaping, one of my favorite things to do was build retaining walls. And I learned some very interesting things about retaining walls very early on. The foundation takes the most time to lay. Once you get the foundation laid, the rest of the wall goes up in no time. But even more important than the foundation as a whole is the first block that you lay on the foundation. because the first block sets the course for the entire wall. If you don't get the first block right, the rest of the foundation's not going to be right. And I think that's what we have going on here. This is the picture I think we should get of the church from this text. Jesus is the most important piece of the foundation of the people of God. But the people of God also become a part of the foundation of his church. Now, I want to make one more point that I think is critical for us to come to understand, especially as I build the foundation for the rest of this series. We need to be aware of this concept that's seen throughout Scripture known as corporate personality. Corporate personality. We see this in the Old Testament as well as the New Testament. Old Testament scholars specifically talk about the suffering servant written of in Isaiah. And when we think of the suffering servant in Isaiah, we think of it being an individual, Jesus, the Messiah. But the suffering servant also represents Israel as a whole. You know, Paul talks about corporate personality in the New Testament, in Romans. I wanted to slide some Romans in here because I know Gary loves Romans. He's always asking me when we're going to talk about Romans. So here, this maybe will be just enough to satisfy him for a little while. This is what Paul says about corporate personality in Romans. He says, "Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, and in this way death came to all people because all sinned." See the corporate personality there? Adam represented all of humanity. And in that one man, he sins, and now because humanity is identified with the one man, Adam, we are all sinners. He goes on to say in verse 15, "But the gift is not like the trespass, for if the many died by the trespass of one man, how much more did God's grace in the gift that came by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, overflow to the many?" So now we have the one man, Jesus, representing all of humanity in the gift. And then you add verse 18 to that. "Consequently, just as one trespass resulted in condemnation for all people, so also one righteous act resulted in justification and life for all people." Here's what's going on. Jesus, the one man Jesus, represents the many to God. So when God looks at Jesus, he literally sees all those who are faithful to him. Now, that's powerful if you really think about that. So when God looks down at us as a whole, he sees Jesus. So the many represent the one man. The one man represents the many. So what does that mean for us as a church? The many represent the one man Jesus to the world. It's not our buildings that represent Jesus to the world. It's us as a community of people. It's not the building where the presence of God resides. It's with us as a community of people. And the presence of God could rest with us in the middle of that cornfield just as easily as it could right here in the nice confines of these four walls. So why is it important for us to talk about the church? Why should we even do a series on the church? Well, you know, I put a Facebook post on there, and I was going to start the Facebook post was, "What comes to your mind when you think of the church?" And then I thought, wait a minute, that might be opening a can of worms. Because for some people, it's not very good. For some people, when they think of the church, they don't think of good things. They've been hurt by the church. They've experienced some nasty stuff. And I was afraid somebody would put on there the truth, because sometimes the church has hurt people. But it's important for us to think about and talk about the church according to the Bible, because when the world looks at the church, we have a corporate personality that represents one person. So the most important question is not, what do people see when they see Hannah's Creek? That's not the most important question. The most important question that we should be asking ourselves is, who do people see when they look at Hannah's Creek? So here's our working definition of the church. We're going to keep building on this. The church is a called out community centered on the person of Jesus Christ. It's a community of people that represent Jesus to the world. And it's a community of people that is represented by Jesus to God. So there's the foundation for the rest of this series. Next week, we're gonna still be right here in Matthew chapter 16 because I still haven't picked apart this one verse right here. So much truth in one verse right there. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. So next week, we'll talk about the purpose and the power of the church. Let's pray.